Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Stephen Downs. Stephen is a world-renowned research officer, Human-Computer Interaction, Information and Communication Technologies, National Research Council of Canada. So, Stephen, you just have a remarkable, outstanding career with many significant contributions that's had some great global impact. So thank you for sharing your deep expertise and wisdom with our audience.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Stephen, you're a real authority in this whole sort of e-learning area. You're a pioneer in this area as well. So can you outline the value of the unique e-learning support system to address skills shortages in the most demanding fields? And that could possibly save significant training costs for companies and educational institutions across the country.
Yeah, what we're working on a project called Learning and Performance Support Systems. It's an outgrowth of the work that we've done over the last 10 or 12 years at National Research Council in the area of e-learning. We've worked on learning management systems and massive open online learning in the past. We're moving to the new type of online learning, which is characterized as personal learning. And the importance of this is to provide each individual person their own access to learning resources, learning libraries, and their own personal learning records. And this, we feel, will have a direct impact into industry in Canada and around the world, for that matter, because it allows people to prepare for jobs before they get onto the job, and it allows people to continue learning while they're on the job. And the importance of personal learning is that it allows people to actually integrate learning into their work environment. And this is something you can only do with e-learning. And it's something really that you require a personal learning framework to do.
Now, it sounds like the platform that you created has many broad applications. Can you define sort of the sectors that can benefit and why?
Well, I should be clear, first of all, we're still in the process of creating it. What we've released is an initial test version in order to get people's reactions and feedback, because it's very important to develop something like this iteratively with real users and real feedback so that we know we're addressing the actual problems that they have. We've looked at industries like oil and gas. We've met with a number of companies and oil and gas educational consortia. They have significant skill shortages in that field, and especially in oil field operations. And we want to be able to use personal learning, particularly learning integrated into mobile devices and support systems, to enable them to address these skill shortages. And that's going to have a significant impact on your bottom line. We're talking about, you know, improving one, I forget the exact nature of it, but it has something to do with removing water from wells. And this one, getting this one operation right saves them tens of millions of dollars. I'm in Boucherville, where we have an NRC laboratory in medical simulations. And about an hour ago, I was practicing neurosurgery on a simulator, and obviously the impact of e-learning here is significant because you don't always have brains to work on. And we're combining the LPSS personal learning functionality, which connects you to resources, learning networks, and experts, with the advanced simulation technology so that you can actually use neural probes to remove cancer tissues in a brain. And, you know, the applications of this are I hope, apparent. And this is the sort of thing, and I'll stress this because I think it's important. This is the sort of thing, like, right now, it's technology that's only beginning to be employed in hospitals. But we want to see this sort of thing more widely available so that we can determine, for example, with students in high schools, whether they have an aptitude and an inclination for neurosurgery, and they can begin to develop the motor skills that they need to develop at a relatively young age, when, you know, it really matters that you begin things that early. You know, when you're a young adult, or, you know, 20, 22, 23, that's almost too late to begin to learn to do things like fine-grained neurosurgery.
Well, that's really fascinating. So what prompted the creation of this platform?
Well, Well, as I said, I've been working and our team has been working in e-learning for the last 10 years or so. And over time, we've seen an increasing need to provide personal learning as opposed to the institution-based or class-based learning that has been previously available. There are several major factors. One is cost. If we can set up a personal learning network with access to resources and learning opportunities from multiple institutions, this creates more of a marketplace for learning than the existing institutional and fairly siloed model that we have now. Having a marketplace enables many more providers to offer resources and services, and it also increases the size of the market for learning resources and services. Both of those bring down costs, and it makes learning much more accessible to people. I just talked about neurosurgery in the high schools. That would be impossible to conceive of otherwise. You can't do it unless you have this sort of learning network. So we developed, as the first step of this massive open online learning, or MOOCs, you may have heard about them, we developed those originally in 2008, and they've been very popular because they show and have proven the value of an open learning marketplace. And now the PLE is the next step in that process. Our LPSS system in particular is the next step in that process by taking these open online learning opportunities and attuning them to individual learning plans, individual personal learning records, in order to focus people's ability to learn from multiple institutions, provide credentials and recognition for that, and make that available to potential employers or current employers.
So do you see sort of taking all of this work that's being done and taking it into the international marketplace in some way?
Oh, absolutely. We're already working in the international marketplace. One project that we're working on, for example, is with the Arab League Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization. They're based in Tunisia. I'm going next week to keynote online Educa Berlin, which is a major international marketplace for e-learning providers. We've worked in the past with organizations like EduCause in the United States, and also Advanced Distributed Learning. They do military applications in e-learning for the United States. We have a long history with them. So, Canada has a history of developing e-learning technologies and services for the export marketplace. We've played a role in that in the past, and we will definitely be playing a role in the future with this technology.
That's fascinating. Do you then sort of link up with people like the ITU, UNESCO, or the Commonwealth of Learning?
Yep. We have contacts with all of them, know them well. With UNESCO, for example, we're well connected with their Open Educational Resources Initiative. We don't have any current projects with them, but we've done work with them in the past. Commonwealth of Learning has something called the Open Education Resources University. That's Wayne McIntosh. He's down in New Zealand. We've worked with them and know them very well. I've done work with OECD. I've written a sustainability model for open educational resources for them. So these bodies are, they're all working with us and we're all working with them.
Recently I was talking to the founding dean at UCI, University of California, Irvine, and they're getting heavy or doing a lot of research in this area, but many, many others. Do you share research with the University of California system at all?
Well, not with them in particular. We don't have a direct interaction with them. We're pretty open with what we do. So, I'm sure they're aware of what we do, but we don't have any current projects with them.
Now, this is an amazing initiative and I guess demonstrates Canadian leadership worldwide, which is recognized. So what underlying trends and research drove this new platform?
Well, there's a few things. Mobile computing is one, and it creates the need to be able to access learning on multiple devices in multiple places. So that's really key. Cloud-based computing is another. The ability to store your learning records in the cloud so that you can access them on any of these devices. Analytics and big data is another area. We haven't really touched on analytics, but a big part of our project is to take the sort of machine reasoning that's available to large companies, for example, recognizing competencies, detecting trends and performances, identifying skills gaps, making that sort of functionality available to individuals working on their own personal learning records directly. So that's been major. We're connected at LPSS with another program in the National Research Council called Multimedia Analytic Technologies for Security. And they do things like monitor Twitter conversations for sentiment. They have automated translators, English, French, English, Arabic, etc. And they do cluster-based, what they call deep learning, where you're looking for patterns in data where you don't know what the pattern is ahead of time. It's just whatever happens to be there, you're able to find it. And so we're incorporating these technologies as well. You know, it's a level of analysis and a level of machine learning that hasn't been available in the past. Now that these things are coming on the stream, it makes a technology like this possible. So it's kind of time for it.
This is somewhat already captured in your profile, which is released with the interview. But can you maybe further provide some insights into your current role and how you wish to drive this program?
Okay, well, I'm the program leader. So they actually let me be in charge of something, which is always interesting for a researcher, because, you know, your career is, you do a lot of research and they keep you away from this, and then one day they open the door. I'm just kidding, of course. I probably shouldn't kid in an interview, but I do. As a program leader, my main role is to provide an overall vision for the program. So the model that we're working on is one that I've developed. It's based on the idea of learning networks. It's based on the idea of a distributed system. It's based on the idea of learning being something that is based on personal development and growth. And in particular, the plasticity of neural connectivity through experience, interaction, and practice. That approach to learning, as opposed to one that might be based in remembering content and reciting facts, there's a very good research and pedagogical basis for this approach. So providing that sort of overall vision. Another part of my role is in developing the market for this technology. So, and that's why I work with these organizations that we mentioned earlier, around the world in order to find the markets, to find the receptor capacity, to identify what their needs are for learning in the workplace, in international development, and in schools and universities, and make sure that what we're developing adapts to that. So, and then there's just the structural mechanics of driving a large research program. I'm here in Boucherville. We're talking about how to connect this program to that technology so that, we can produce a better overall result. And, what kind of skills do we need? What's our work program look like? Working with different companies, what would the actual deliverables be? These are all things that I'm involved with. It's a bit of a departure from writing software and writing papers, to be sure. But it's interesting, and it wouldn't be possible without that background. So I'm enjoying this new role.
You know, it's fascinating. Earlier you talked about neuroplasticity. So are you following the brain initiatives in Europe and also in the U.S. and the research being done here? And I guess the second part of this question is, and it's somewhat related, is there's a lot of work in machine learning and deep learning systems where they're trying to mimic mm-hmm. what's happening in terms of our neural nets. Are you following that research and maybe seeing how that can integrate into maybe big data analytics in the learning platform?
I do follow that work. I don't follow it at as deep a level as a researcher immersed in that field would be, which is unfortunate. I wish I had the time. But I'm definitely following that research. I'm following the work in connectionism and neural network technology and, in computer science. You see a lot of this sort of stuff reflected in my newsletter. So, if I see stuff there, I pass that on to the educational community, and it forms sort of the background knowledge that informs the approach that we're taking to learning and development. Especially, it's funny, people always say, and I see this in the conversation almost every day, we don't really know very much about how the brain works. And it's not true. We know a huge amount about how the brain works. Particularly in sensory perception and the initial processing of incoming signal by successive layers of neurons, creation of 3.5D representations of visual phenomena. We know how these things work, and as well, the mathematics and the algorithms under neural networks and deep learning, there's a huge literature in these subjects, and they overlap considerably with the neurophysiology. So we know a lot about how the brain works. What we don't know is how to map that to what's commonly called folk psychology, the language of beliefs and intentions and desires and the like. So no, we can't say what it means neurologically to say Paris is the capital of France, but we can tell, at the micro level, a very detailed and involved story about the mechanisms that lead to that physical utterance.
So, you know, that, again, that's just a fascinating what's being done, and I guess your newsletter would be a great vehicle to keep up with all the work that you're doing.
Yeah, that's, one of the philosophies that underlies the approach to learning that we're working on is working openly. So, we don't go away into a lab for 3 years and come out with, eureka, I've done it, because science doesn't work that way anymore. And working openly means sharing, the things that I find and my thoughts about those things as they happen on a regular basis. So I do this newsletter, I do it pretty much every work day, occasional weekends, if I'm like that. And it's a way to sort of see the thinking develop, not just in my own mind, but in the field as a whole.
So Steve, it's just fascinating what you described in terms of your role and how you wish to build out the program. So how will you measure the success of the program?
Well, it's difficult to measure directly the impact of something like this because we work in a network economy and all of the outcomes have multiple causes. But some of the significant things are the receptor capacity for our technologies, if we're able to commercialize it, if we're able to obtain licensing for any of the unique technologies that we develop, that indicates an interest in the community. If we can create an effect in the economy as a whole, for example, in jobs created or revenue generated by the Canadian IT industry as a result of innovations of ours that they're using, if we can create impact in the end user sectors like oil and gas or medicine, lowering their training costs, reducing their losses due to, workplace errors or accidents, and also reducing the cost of, education for people in Canada, for example, lowering the cost of access to professional credentials, things like that. All of these would be good indicators for us.
Now, Stephen, on the commercialization side, are you going to be working with investment bankers and that kind of thing?
Probably not with investment bankers. We work directly with technology companies, and NRC generally does that. So we're not creating spin-off companies particularly. We're working with companies that already exist in Canada and helping them develop their capacity.
Now, you've already talked about this, I guess, throughout this interview so far, but can you talk more about the value to the country itself?
Well, yeah. I mean, Canada depends on, having a significant technological lead, over and above being a resource-based economy. We're an information-based economy, and part of that, a big part of that, is leading in specific fields like instructional technology and e-learning. And being a world leader in this area has a more widespread impact for the country as a whole because when you look at Canada, you say, oh yeah, Canada is the established leader in e-learning. Part of that means Canada is an established leader in information technologies generally, and that creates opportunities for other industries. I find this most prevalent when I think about the impact on my own city. I live in Moncton, New Brunswick, which many people have never heard of. Certainly outside Canada, people have never heard of Moncton, New Brunswick. But, you know, I go to India, or I go to Berlin, or I go to Riyadh, and I say, hello, I'm from Moncton, New Brunswick, and this is where we're developing these world-leading technologies. Moncton, now, as a city, as a whole, receives brand recognition that it never would have before. And we see, you know, Moncton, the city, is one of the most rapidly developing economies in Canada, which is, you know, you don't normally associate that with a place like New Brunswick. Now, it would be ridiculous for me to claim credit for that, but it has to have an impact. And it has to be a positive impact, not a negative one.
So what is your global expansion program and how will it be executed? I know you talked about the fact that you're talking to UNESCO, ITU, Commonwealth Learning, many others, and there's going to be a lot of international value with this platform you're creating. So how will the execution occur?
Well, pragmatically and opportunistically. it's hard to say. We're building what amounts to a core platform. Part of that is the establishment of standards and protocols. Part of that is the leveraging of existing standards and protocols. We're trying to create an overall environment where, if you will, there's a single network for learning, so that one person's personal learning environment will work in any of a wide number of areas. And then, you know, like whether it be university, on-the-job training, development training, community development, things like that. And then from there, we pretty much take, on a case-by-case basis, example initiatives. And this is where the opportunistic part comes in, right? Where there's opportunity for us to showcase this approach and show how it benefits the learners and the institutions supporting them, that's what we do. So, for example, with Alexa, which is the Arab League organization, we're working with these countries in order to develop literacy development capacity so that people inside the countries are able to become literate, especially in Arabic, but also in other languages. But we're also doing a capacity building community formation exercise using the same technology because it supports that. I've also talked with organizations in Colombia, for example. Colombia as well is doing community development. I've worked with people in Medellin. They have completely different challenges than the Arab League, but the same underlying approach of personal learning and development and access to open educational resources for them is significant and important. At the same time, we have projects going with the oil and gas industry, completely different environment, completely different learning needs, but if we can prove that the same underlying technology works for them as works for the Arab League, as works for people in Colombia, now we've created a path for a person in Colombia to be able to develop the abilities, skills, contacts, community, and network to progress from, you know, a building in Medellin to working with an oil and gas company in Saudi or something like that. So that's the model, right? It's picking these places where we're able to find opportunity and resources to show, here's this technology working in such and such an environment, and then here's how the work in this environment can connect up with work in other environments in order to provide progress and mobility for a person through these different environments.
Again, it's fascinating. I can clearly see the value. So what are some of the top resources in your program?
I'm not sure what you mean. What are some of the top resources?
URL links, position papers,
okay.
Portals.
Sure. The major access point for LPSS is a website called lpss.me. And that's the access into the pre-alpha, and I emphasize pre-alpha version of it. And what you can do there is request an invitation, and then we send out the invitations. You can sign up for LPSS, go in and take a look at what we've actually developed so far. Still early days. It's important to remember. It's still early days. People say, you know, the future comes on so quickly. When you're actually working on building the future, it's not very fast. It doesn't feel very fast. My own website is also very useful. This is me working openly. My URL is www.downes.ca for Canada, because the branding is important. And there, on that website, you'll find something like 300 presentations, most of them with audio recordings, most of them with slides, some of them with video. You'll also find my newsletter, and you'll be able to subscribe to my newsletter from that site, and that'll connect you to a whole bunch of other stuff as well, you know, the whole network of related initiatives around the world. Also on my website, you can find the papers that I've presented over the years, you know, the publications. I really should keep that more up to date than I do. And there's a link to my blog, which is just, well, it's a blog. It's me talking about these things on a more general basis. There is my web blog of half an hour, and that's just a Blogspot website, so the address is halfanhour.blogspot.ca. And then on the National Research Council of Canada site, and I'd be hard pressed of the program, outlines the different projects underneath the program and gives you contact information if you're interested in working with us or doing business development with us.
Now, I should mention to the audience that this call is being done using Skype technologies, and of course, with the internet, sometimes we get dropouts. So we lost the audio on the from the part where you're talking about the NRC site. Just wanted to let the audience know that sometimes we do lose a bit of audio because this is done over the internet, this interview. And we just did lose some of the audio on the NRC site. Can you repeat that portion about the NRC site and then...
Sure. There's the National Research Council of Canada site, I can't give you the exact URL for the LPSS program page, but if you search for the LPSS on National Research Council of Canada, you'll find the information about our program, the different projects, and contact information if you want to follow up, work with us, or do business with us.
Now, what are the typical engagement look like? So you talked about, you know, I'm interested in looking at this program. You've given us a plethora of different resources that we can access to get more information to keep up in this space. But let's say I now sign up for this system. What do I do from there?
Well, okay, yeah, like you say, what does a typical engagement look like? There's no typical engagement, right? If you sign up for the system, again, keep in mind it's a pretty early version of the system, but what the system allows you to do is to define and access educational resources through a resource aggregator. It allows you to identify competencies that you're interested in working on, which is the beginnings of developing a learning plan. The system will recommend resources based on those competencies. There's the beginnings of a personal learning record store, and right now, because we're still in development, you can actually hop into the underlying graph and go graph hopping, if you will, looking at how we've structured the data underneath and go from concept to concept, which I find interesting, but it might be a bit obscure for many people. You can actually access the learning resources and look at them and use them. That's about what you can do right now. We're working on layering over and on top of that the social network infrastructure. That's not there yet, but you can imagine you're doing all of this within the context of your social networks. You can also define your social network sites, however, so you can integrate your Twitter accounts with LPSS. You can integrate your cloud storage account with LPSS to manage your own documents. We also have what we call a toolkit, and this allows you, if it's one of these things where you drag it and drop it into your bookmarks tab on your web browser, and then as you surf the web, you have LTSS coming along with you, and you can comment on resources, save the resource to your own library, etc. So there's some things to explore in what we've done. So that's, you know, that's on an individual level, engaging with the technology itself, and then there are many ways to engage with us on a, from a development perspective. We're always open to new development partners. We're looking at extending the capacity of LPSS into external systems as much as possible, because the idea is that it's not an application that you come and use. It's an application that goes to you wherever you're learning things or doing things. So if you're a tool provider or a resource provider, we're interested in talking to you to make sure LPSS integrates with the work that you're doing. And then if you're a technology developer, you know, we're looking at collaborative research. We will do focused research to adapt LPSS to your particular use cases or user stories. You know, just depending on the, you know, depending on the resources we can bring to bear and the resources that our partners can bring to bear. And that's the subject of longer conversations, of course.
You know, it's kind of fascinating, this sort of this engagement process and sort of discovering and working with your system. I'm just curious, have you worked at all with Murray Goldberg and his crew at in the past?
I know Murray. I know the work that he's done with WebCT. I was at the presentation at NAWeb many years ago, back in the 90s, when he presented the Perl version of WebCT. And I followed his career, but I'm not in touch with him. I'm working with him directly at this point. Although if he's listening, Murray, give me a call, because, you know, we've had long and parallel careers in the industry.
Well, I'm just thinking, I know that, a colleague of his, Terry Cota, who's, on the ACM, the Association of Computing Machinery Q, board, and he's also on the practitioner board, he's worked with Murray on this learning management system for the marine industry, and it's pretty up to date. And then I know Terry has also created some kind of a social platform as well. And I'm just thinking that it'd be good for you to sit down with both Terry Cota and Murray.
Yeah, well, I'm always happy to do that. Absolutely, for sure. Especially, you know, I mean, if we're working from a Canadian context, I'm particularly interested in talking to them and, you know, developing opportunities with them.
Well, they definitely have done that. So, and their platform is now pretty mature. So, and it's new, reflecting all the latest technologies. Now, in terms of this next question then, and we're sort of going to deviate from some of the things that we talked about so far, but we're going to sort of focus on your career. So can you describe your most significant and influential achievements and then the practical outcomes seen today and then forecast it into the future?
That's kind of a tough question, because, you know, achievement is in the eyes of the beholder, and so other people have a different perspective on these things than I do. It's interesting. The most significant achievement is one of the oldest, and that's my site called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies. I released that in 95. And basically it was a open, easily accessible website that described all the logical fallacies. And that's probably my most read resource ever. And people today don't really associate it with me anymore. I get emails and say, are you the same person? You know, more recently, perhaps the Massive Open Online Course, which I mentioned earlier, we developed the first Massive Open Online Course. We developed the concept, the ideas behind it, and technology supporting that, for example, the application called Grasshopper, which has never been a commercial application, but has been a research platform of mine. And, you know, MOOCs have become this worldwide phenomena. Time magazine called 2012, the Year of the MOOC. You know, we've got millions of people and dozens of different companies offering MOOCs around the world. So that's pretty significant. And I think that's important. my career began, interestingly, in 1998 with a paper I authored called The Future of Online Learning, which, you know, projected into the future. I thought of that paper right away. I followed that up with a 10-year on version of it called The Future of Online Learning 10 Years On. And I'll probably do one 20 years on in 2 or 3 years. The future learning is more personal, it's more distributed, it's more accessible, it's a commodity in one sense, it's a utility in others. I expect learning to be like electricity or like water or like language or writing, where it's just where you need it, when you need it. This idea that we would stop everything and go to a special place to learn has always struck me as odd and strange. And why would we do that? You can see that maybe for an industrialized model, but, you know, for an information society, it's an odd sort of thing to do. It's like going to the computer room to use your computer in a world where we all have one in our pocket. And that's where the future is going. And that's the future I'm working toward. And to me, it's important because education, learning, access to knowledge, abilities, skills, resources, these are all not simply ways of making the economy better, although they're sort of like that, but they're ways of making the individual lives of people better. It helps them develop their own selves, their own capacities to the greatest extent possible. It allows them to lead fuller, and more interesting and more enjoyable lives. And ultimately, that's, you know, in the end, that's the objective of this program, is to make that opportunity available to people. And that's what I work toward in my own career.
Well, it's just an amazing and fascinating career. And as you indicated, you're an early pioneer in the MOOC movement. And I know a lot of the media sort of focuses on Stanford, I guess, and Andrew Ng and the work he's done and then leading to Coursera, but you preceded that by many, many years. So, kudos to all the work that you've done. Jim, just very significant. And of course, coming out of Canada too, right? So now I just kind of delve into past, present, and future. Maybe some people that inspire you.
People that inspire me. That's a good one. I'm just trying to remember his name. Our Chris Hadfield inspired me. And he's more recent inspiration, obviously. But, you know, you talk about working openly and demonstrating the enthusiasm for what you do. Chris Hadfield, of course, is the Canadian astronaut who recently commanded the International Space Station. That's inspiring to me. David Suzuki inspired. He's a geneticist who now, of course, is known as an environmental activist. But when you listen to him talk, you can see the story go from the science, you know, the hard, deep science of genetics and life and ecosystems, and you can see where his philosophy develops out of that. And that's very, you know, I've always told people, you know, my science is not based on my politics are based on my science. And he's a good example of that. So he's another person that inspires me. John Stuart Mill, who of course is no longer with us and hasn't been with us for more than 100 years, again, inspires me. He inspires me because he talks about liberty. He inspires me because, he's the person who came up with the idea of, society being based in diversity and each person pursuing their own good in their own way. But he's also perhaps lesser known as, you know, the author of On the Subjection of Woman. He's well known for promoting the idea, it's a Kantian idea, but he espouses it, that each life is valuable and each person contributes their own distinctiveness to the social fabric, and that's really important to me. And it's important to me on many different levels, including the scientific level. You can't do science with just scientists. You need contributions from across society. Writers, artists, economists, actual scientists, engineers, the rest. I'm not going to name every occupation and discipline. So he inspires me. Who else would inspire me? There's lots of people who inspire me.
So have you had the chance to talk to Chris or David at all?
I've talked with David, not recently, but I have talked with him in the past. I've never met Chris Hadfield. I would love to meet with him one day. Because the work that he's done has really inspired me.
You're quite an eclectic person. You have many interests. You've done a lot. You've been a Canadian pioneer and also an internationally recognized pioneer for all the contributions you've made. Is there anything that continues to surprise you?
Life. Everything surprises me. That's a good question. I haven't really thought of it in terms of surprise. Each day to me is a unique experience. And, it's not only a perspective, it's actually true. And so there's always surprises to me. I find surprises in things like symmetries, parallelisms. You look at a common street scene and two people are doing exactly the same things on different sides of the street. That's a surprise. How does that happen? I'm surprised at the inventiveness of people. Everywhere I turn, there's a tool being used for some purpose other than which it was designed. And well beyond the typical using, an Apple computer as a doorstop. But, my early career involved using, a multi-million-dollar international, computer network created by Texas Instruments to play chess because we could. And today, people use the internet, a multi-billion dollar system, to exchange cat photos because they can. And I think that's wonderful. I mean, the whole idea of, us exchanging cat photos using the most advanced communication system ever designed, it's fascinating, wonderful, and amazing to me. And it really tells us what's at the core of all of these inventions and all, and why we're doing them. And we're not doing them for the sort of purposes that economists might say. We're not trying to pursue advantage, maximize our economic return. We're sharing cat photos. There's no economic return to that. Well, except maybe for the creators of Garfield. There's that aspect. It's something I call the butterfly thesis. And the butterfly thesis, this is not the wings of a butterfly will create chaotic effects. This is a different butterfly thesis. And if you drive through eastern Canada, you see that people put wooden butterflies on the front of their houses, big wooden butterflies. And you ask, why have they done this? It's not easy to attach big wooden butterflies to the front of your house, but they do it, and they do it because they like them. And so much human activity is like that. It's like putting butterflies in the front of your house. You're not doing it for any particular purpose, symbolic or otherwise. You're doing it because you like butterflies. And those are the things that amaze me. Everything that is done without a purpose, everything that is done randomly, everything that is done simply as a result of interaction. And, there's, I see 100 instances of those every day, and it's being able to see that, and I see that in every society, every country I visit, no matter how rich, no matter how poor, you see that. And it's this thing that underlies economies, underlies science, underlies art, that's beneath all of that, and it's uniquely human. And I think it's wonderful and endlessly interesting.
Your conversation in terms of some of the things that surprise you just kind of triggered a thought. I read this news announcement from Microsoft where they predicted the last or the final 15 matches of the World Cup with 100% accuracy. And they even published the results prior to the match, and they got the last 15 out of 15, or the Scottish referendum. They predicted it, what was going to happen, and it's part of their Bing system, and it uses their deep neural nets that are as part of their prediction system, or Andrew Ng when I had an interview with him. Andrew, of course, is on leave from Stanford as their director of AI. Started the Brain Project at Google. He's been hired right now by Baidu to head up their research in deep learning. And then, of course, he's the chairman of Coursera. But he talked about this system that they created, and it taught itself this concept of cat just by watching YouTube videos. I was in Washington. I was invited to a group, I guess it was about 20 researchers, funded by the National Science Foundation, and Grady Booch did a talk, and Grady is the chief scientist at IBM Research. But as part of his presentation, he made these assertions about the mind is computable, the universe is digital, the universe is the 3D hologram. But he spent some time talking about this whole idea of the mind is computable, and I thought it was kind of fascinating. And then you have Elon Musk making out some really interesting statements about artificial intelligence and deep learning systems and the impact it's going to have on society. And I see similar statements of Bill Joy. What do you think about all of this and these comments coming out that maybe this is in the nearer term and not in the sort of longer term? Or I had a conversation with Tom Mitchell at Carnegie Mellon. He heads up their AI area, their machine learning area, and he has this project called the NEL, Never Ending Language Learner, where it's teaching itself to read the web. And I said, well, give me a date when you think it'll be complete. He said, maybe 10 years, when it will have read and consumed and sort of understands what's on the web. And there's a lot of implications to that. So what are your views on all of that?
Well, so let's go with the mind is computable, and computability is a technical term. And basically the assertion is that the mind is Turing complete. As anything the mind can do is something that we could instantiate in theory on a computer, which is probably true, because any physical system basically is going to be Turing complete. But that may be a controversial statement. I don't think of it as controversial, but it might be thought of that way. But today when people think computable, they don't think of this underlying technical definition. They think computable, oh yeah, like a computer with software and programs and things like that. But that's not how the mind works. I'm pretty sure of that. I say that from my perspective of, I'm not the deep neurophysicist, I'm not the deep computer scientist, but I'm still pretty sure that the mind doesn't work like a computer with programs and algorithms, things like that. So when we say the mind is computable, it does not mean that there's some computer program that could be like a mind. And that's an important understanding. A program like the Never-Ending Language Learner, for example, or the program that detects, that learns about cats, by looking at YouTube videos. These are not programs in the typical sense of computer programs. They're going, and I'm speaking without direct familiarity with them, but I know how these things work. They're going to be neural network programs. They're going to be instantiations of deep learning algorithms where the knowledge is created by assigning values and weights to connections between hundreds, thousands, millions, billions of neurons. This language learner, when in 10 years it has learned the language, let's suppose that happened, we're not going to learn about language by opening up the language learner and seeing how it's programmed, because it's going to be just as opaque to us as the human brain, which also has learned language. So there's an interesting thing happening here. Like, we will be able to develop these systems, but in an important sense, we won't necessarily be able to understand them. Why is that important? Well, now, the other aspect of what you talked about was the predictability of events such as the World Cup or such as the Scottish referendum. And macro events, and especially mass-based events, are not as stochastic as micro events. they're easier to predict. It's easier, for example, to predict the movement of a boulder than it is to predict the movement of a pile of sand that was once that very same boulder. Once you get into micro movements and interactions of multiple entities with each other, things get much more difficult to describe, much less predict. And so while it may seem that computer technology is going to take all the fun out of life, and, you know, it'll remove the mystery of watching the World Cup and things like that, I think that the opposite is true. It'll take the mystery out of things that should not be mysteries, like mass phenomena, and we will understand the properties of those better and be able to control those to a much greater extent, which will help us. But it will also focus our minds to the underlying layer beneath all of this, which is made out of many small interacting moving parts, and we'll be able to see these interactions much more clearly, much more crisply, and we'll begin to appreciate them that much more. Because they won't be predictable. They'll be like, microclimates. You won't know what the local weather is going to be, even if you can predict with certainty that it's going to rain tomorrow. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I mean, that's a whole nother interview though, right? Where we're going.
Yeah.
Now we're going to get back to sort of your expertise in this whole learning environment, and this question has to do with policy. What improvements in policy should happen in the next coming years?
Well, it's hard to talk about policy particularly because policy involves so much more than simply what's good, if that makes any sense. For example, I might say something like, we should make access to e-learning available to every single person. And now that sounds, it sounds like a policy recommendation, but if I say that, it's going to be based on the science and the pedagogy, right? This would produce the best result from a learning perspective. But policy isn't like that. Policy brings in other factors, it brings in political factors, it brings in economic factors. So I talk about the sort of environment that would support access to learning, and I think of things like open educational resources. I think that's important. I think about copyright law that supports educational purposes. And some of this is already in place, some of it's not already in place, and don't ask me which is in place and which isn't, because I don't know the entire details, although Michael Geist at the University of Ottawa does know, and he'll tell you exactly what's in place that should be and exactly what's not in place that shouldn't be. But I mean, we're looking at things like, we're looking at things that, how do I want to phrase this? That enable people to use resources for the purpose of education, for the purpose of learning, to the greatest extent possible. So, learning is based in, to a large degree, on sharing and openness. So creating environments where we can share open resources is a good thing. Now, whether that involves government producing these resources or whether that involves, legislation so that individuals can produce these resources and put them into the public domain. That sort of question is going to go beyond what I would recommend. I just want to see people having access to learning resources. Similarly, with the communications technologies underlying it, we know how important these communications technologies are. We've just been involved in setting up this conversation. We met around the Skype. I'm using my telephone. We need to have the capacity to have that conversation, which means, it needs to be reasonably affordable. It means that, the infrastructure, the bandwidth and the audio technology, that uses that bandwidth needs to be available and accessible to me at a reasonable price. And we need to know that the call is not going to drop, at least not too frequently. Stuff like that. What are the mechanisms to put that in place? That depends on a variety of factors. How's that for a non-answer?
That's a good answer, you know, because it's a pretty open question. Now, the next question is about is about computing, and you know, should computing be a recognized profession like accounting or medicine and others? And really, the elements of a computing profession will be things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, recognized credentials. What are your feelings on that?
Well, I'm not sure medicine and accounting should be recognized quite that way, but that's a separate story. I mean, computing is a profession. I think there's no question about it. But videography and cinematography and those things are regarded, you know. So, and that's why, you know, like the Webby Awards and things like that are perfectly appropriate forms of recognition. Other aspects of computing are more like engineering. You know, and there's the whole discipline of computer engineering. And here, it's more about international standards, ISO recognition, processes, methodologies. There's a bunch of things there that, like I say, it's more like engineering than it is like being a doctor or being a lawyer. Things like information architecture are partially philosophy and should be thought of that way, and partially a profession and should maybe be thought of that way. So there isn't this thing that is computing that should be thought of as a profession in the way medicine is thought of as a profession. That said, all aspects of computing or any discipline should be informed by ethics. You know, I think that, you know, I'd love to introduce ethics to other professions, so economics, and I think librarians should have ethics. No, I'm just kidding there. I think librarians do have ethics, actually. So, you know, I'm sort of agreeing that it is, but I'm sort of saying that it isn't. It's not as simple, you know, you ask for a simple answer, I think, and I think the answer is that it's not simple. There isn't a single profession that we think there is. There isn't a single approach to these sorts of issues as we may think there is, even in things like medicine and accounting.
Well, we're down to our last few questions, and it's going to be in three parts. The first part is I just want you to share one or more stories that you think you found it fascinating, and it could be in your travels or your work or your speaking. The next question will be about some of the challenges you'd faced and how you propose to be solved. And the last one is free form, and that is I'm going to pretend that you're doing the interview, so what questions should I have asked you, and then what would be your answers? But so we're down to our last three questions. So starting with the first one, then, do you have any story that you want to share? It could be a personal story or something you found interesting.
I have a billion stories. Which one is most relevant? There, I don't think in terms of stories. I should say that perhaps first of all. I think in terms of images and environments and maybe sometimes encounters. The image that's most in my head right now is I took a train. I did a talk and some workshops in Yerevan in Armenia, and there's a whole bunch of images from there. But I took a train from Yerevan overnight to Tbilisi, which is the capital of Georgia. And you get out of the train, and one of the things I've noticed is Yerevan, it's like this, and Tbilisi, it's like this, and I think it's probably true of other cities in the region where the car is dominant, and so you don't have crosswalks so much as you have tunnels underneath the roads. Any major road, or any major intersection, you have a tunnel underneath the intersection. And what happens in these environments, and it's become more formalized, especially in a place like Yerevan, is they're not just tunnels, but they're a whole wealth of shops. You see that in England as well, under Oxford Square, for example, it's like a whole mall, or Montreal's underground city. But in these places, and in some rural places, it's not like a mall, it's more like this warren of small shops and electronics and things like that. And I got into Georgia, into Tbilisi. I got out of the train. There's this busy road right in front of the train station. You have to cross the road. So, of course, you go under it. This first day of winter or thereabouts, it's kind of cold. I went under it, and it was like, it was quiet, it was muffled. There weren't all the electronics that you would normally see there. In other parts of Tbilisi, there are, so it's not like they don't have electronics in Tbilisi. But it was this environment under there. It was stall after stall after stall of clothing, and generally used clothing. And there was sort of this, almost this air of desperation in this underground environment. And it just strikes me. You know, Tbilisi is a modern, progressive, industrial age, information age city. They have everything that we have and probably more, but they have this as well. And it's just that image sticks in my mind that, Thomas Friedman famously says the world is flat, and you go to a place like Tbilisi and you say, yeah, the world is flat. You know, I can buy exactly the same phone that I can buy here on the day it comes out, I can buy in Tbilisi. But in this underground walkway under the highway at the train station in Tbilisi, the world is not flat. And it's people who are trying to get maybe $5 or $10 for the day to live on by selling used clothes in this unheated and almost unlit passageway. And everybody's quiet and everybody's muffled. And that's the image that sticks in my mind as the sort of thing that is important. So that's my story. It's not really a story.
I really enjoyed that sort of sharing. Now, is there one particular challenge that you see that we are faced with and you think that should be solved or some more energy put into it?
And besides that one? there are these huge, massive social challenges, right? And we're familiar with the list. The list runs from global warming to income inequality to, diseases like Ebola and cancer to sectarianism and factionalism and warfare. If there's a common element to all of those, it's the individual human condition, because all of these are problems that are created by, in one way or another, by people who are desperate, who feel they have nothing to lose. You don't go out in the morning and say, I think I'll do something that kills the planet today. I want to destroy the environment. Nobody does that. They do the things they do because they need to make their way through their lives. And get enough food and put clothes on your back and try to be happy for a little bit. So that's the thing that we need to understand and that we need our technologies to touch. If we solve the problem of the human condition, we create at the same time the solutions to all of these other problems, because then people feel empowered. Then people have capacities and skills. Then people can mobilize themselves in society to address these things. A person who's looking forward to a long and productive life does not become a suicide bomber. A community that is strong and sharing doesn't encounter the sorts of issues that these communities that are facing the Ebola virus are facing. They're able to address this sort of thing at the outset rather than when it involves 1,000 people. So finding ways of touching each individual life and helping each person have enough stability, security, and potential and hope in their life, I think that's the key problem that we have to address. And the first part of that is understanding that this is a value, that we need to do it. And then secondly, creating the systems and technologies that actually make this possible.
Okay, we're down to our last question. And I'm saying that if you were conducting this interview, maybe what one question would you have asked and then what would be your answer?
That's kind of a hard question. It's a pretty wide-ranging and comprehensive interview. It's been a lot of fun. It's interesting you didn't ask me about my background and my education, because people listening to this are simply going to assume that, you know, I'm maybe a computer scientist or maybe an educator of some sort. And so maybe you should have asked about that, you know, because my background is in philosophy. Although I guess that sort of came out a little bit too in my answers. But you know, it's one of these things where people assume, you know, philosophy degree, what are you going to do with that? You know? And, you know, I heard that an awful lot while I was studying philosophy, and the answer at that time was, well, I don't know. But I know these are important questions, and I need to address them, because I'm not going to be happy doing anything else until I know or have an idea of the answers to these questions. So that's one thing. Another question you might have asked is, you know, well, what motivates you? Why are you doing any of this? You know, because there's the presumption that people do all this stuff just because it's a job. And this is actually what I talked about in Armenia, right? You know, I mean, we assume that everybody's trying to get ahead, but Armenia is a country filled with monasteries, including one monastery where, you know, monks would live for decades in these cells, in holes cut in the rock. And you don't do that for economic advantage. And so finding out the motivations of someone or why they're doing what they're doing, I think is important. Everybody has a different reason for it. You know, everybody is led to their careers, as a result of a combination of different factors, and understanding those factors and getting people to reflect on them tells you a lot about what they're doing and why they're doing it. So I guess those are two questions I would have asked.
Well, Stephen, that's the end of this conversation that we had, and I know your schedule is demanding, so we in the audience are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, and thank you for sharing so much of your insights, experience, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to talk about this stuff. Working openly, right?
So I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Stephen Downs, world-renowned research officer, human-computer interaction, information communication technologies, National Research Council of Canada.